Hello, everybody, and welcome to the second community call of the 2017 Integral Living Room. I'm Jeff Salzman. I'm your host for tonight, and I am here with my co-hosts, Diane Musho-Hamilton in Salt Lake. You in Salt Lake tonight, Di?
No, Jeff. As a matter of fact, I'm in southern Utah. I'm down in a really tiny town where we often do meditation retreats in Torrey, Utah. So I'm really happy to be on the call. It's great to be here.
And you were finishing up the building of your new temple down there, right?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, we've been involved in the last year in creating a Zendo down here and moving from when we have sessions, meditation sessions, to sitting in a building from sitting in a tent. So it's a big developmental moment for us.
Oh, yeah. And a developmental moment for the Integral, for the Integral movement and for humanity.
Yeah.
Well, just share with the people what you're putting over the gate.
Yeah, we had, it's funny. I purchased these trusses for the inside of the building. It's a 1,500 square foot building. It doesn't have a lot of functions except for a sitting hall, and they happen to have a Japanese torii style gate. You know, those entryways to Japanese temples. They happen to have one on their property. Go figure. So. I purchased that along with the trusses from them, and we're going to dedicate that. We're calling it a Dharma Gate dedicated to Ken Wilber for how many people he's brought to spiritual practice, and in our case, just, helped to awaken them. So I'm really excited to be able to honor Ken.
I just think that is so cool.
Yeah, me too.
Yeah, well, thanks, and welcome, Di. And
yeah,
then
thanks.
Our other cohort, Terry Patton. Hey, Terry, how you doing tonight?
Hey, great to hear you, Jeff. I'm so excited about your new temple, Jedi. It's nice to celebrate that with you.
Thank you.
And I am a little pre-celebration, jamming on the last less than a week before I turn in the manuscript for my book on spiritual activism. So I'm all tuned into our topic and ready to rock and roll with you, Jeff.
Right on. Well, and that is the topic. That's the topic of the Integral Living Room this year. We do a different topic each year. And the topic is a shout from the heart, integral activism. And it was actually a topic that was chosen before the election, but it comes in extra handy at the election in the world of Trump. So we are going to, as is legally mandated these days, talk about Trump and Trumpism tonight and what the integral response to that is, or can be. I really offer that as more of a koan than something that we've sorted out. But the living room consists of, as we know, four community calls, and this is the second of the four this year, and these are free, of course. And then an event gathering at the Integral Center in Boulder, Colorado, and that is this year, November 9th through 12th. So that's a Thursday night through a Sunday noonish. And it's really wonderful. You know, it really is something to be with people who are, on a good day flying at a sort of integral altitude. And there's an X factor that arises. And that's why we say that the Integral Living Room is why we call it the living room, because we have the greatest conversations of our life. And an early bird is still available for the next 3 weeks. It ends 3 weeks from tonight. So if you're going to register, do soon. And, so that's it. So we're going to turn our attention to the question at hand. And Terry and Diane and I are going to share our thoughts on the topic. And then we're actually going to, as we have done in the last couple calls, and it works really well, do a popcorn session where we hear from you. And we ask for a 60, maximum 90-second contribution about what you think the integral response or how you're dealing with this phenomena in culture. So that's the plan. We'll end the call at 7:15 for us here in Mountain Time. And I think that gets us going. So, yeah, Terry, you wanted to bring us the news. And, Jesus, why don't you just get going?
Well, we all have already heard this news, but it's like we haven't been able to integrate the last shocking piece of news before it was overwhelmed by the next. So I thought it might be helpful just to offer the quick reminders of what's happened in the last 3 weeks. About 3 weeks ago, Donald Trump was celebrating in the Rose Garden with House Republicans after they passed the repeal-replace of Obamacare. But the next day, Sally Yates was testifying to the Senate Intelligence Committee, and she revealed that she had told Don McGahn that she believed Michael Flynn might have been compromised by Russia and had lied about 18 days before the White House fired him. The next day, Trump fired James Comey, the director of the FBI, and his spokespeople said that he'd simply accepted the recommendations of the Deputy Attorney General, Rod Rosenstein. That next day, Trump met in the Oval Office with Sergey Lavrov and Sergey Kislyak and revealed code word intelligence from Israel to them. He also told them that Comey was a real nut job and that by firing him, the extreme pressure he had been under was now gone. We didn't know that at the time. We just knew that there had been a meeting. Trump then, the next day, had an interview on NBC where he publicly undercut all his spokespeople's reasons for firing Comey, saying he decided before he even got Rosenstein's memo and that he did it because of the Russian probe. And then the next day, it was revealed that Trump had asked Comey for his loyalty to the president. And then we found out about the revelation of the secret Israeli intelligence to the Russians. And then Trump, people were very upset about that, but then Trump claimed he had an absolute right to do so. The next day, it came out that Comey had recorded contemporaneous memos detailing his conversations with Trump, including one in which Trump brought up the investigation of Michael Flynn and calling Flynn a good guy and asking Comey to let it go. The next day, the Deputy Attorney General appointed Robert Mueller to serve as a special counsel investigating the Russian meddling and any links to the Trump campaign. Then it was revealed that Flynn had told the transition that he was under investigation for lobbying for Turkey, and that he had done so before he put the kibosh on an attack on Raqqa that Turkey had opposed, which has raised a lot of eyebrows. Then the nut job comment came out publicly, as does the comment about the pressure of the investigation now being taken off. And then Trump got in a plane and flew off for Saudi Arabia, Israel, Rome, and Brussels. And then it came out that a high White House official close to Trump speculated to be his son-in-law, Jared Kushner, was under investigation. And now, just yesterday, it came out that a Russian-generated fake news story may have influenced FBI thinking, including perhaps tipping Comey's decision to comment publicly and critically after the Bureau thought it had completed the investigation into Hillary Clinton's email server. And Trump is about to return to the United States. Here we are. Let's talk.
All right. Should we give everybody just a couple breaths to let it all sink in and, you know, sort of make space for it? This is reality. And as Trump always said, it's good to be friendly to reality. Or at least
maybe I can just add one little thing, which is in his speech to NATO, everyone knows, he pushed NATO around in terms of wanting to demand more from NATO in terms of their, what he considers their financial obligations. But maybe even more striking is that the video of him that's been circulating on social media where he literally pushed the Prime Minister of Montenegro out of the way so he could get to this, be front and center in a photograph. That was really interesting to watch. So I just want to add that, just because it's kind of going on.
Yeah, well, I think that's some of what we're talking about here is, I think, what's the worm that's turned in the last few weeks is the realization among people who are paying attention to that Trump is not sort of all there, in a way. I mean, I talk about him as being red. I mean, if we try to use the integral map, he is naturally authoritarian. He's egocentric. He's, pushes people out of the way, literally, and has this sort of warlord or mafia kingpin kind of vibe where he just wants to keep all the eyeballs on him, and so every day it's a new outrage. And this injection of red into the culture has been really traumatic, and I'm not sure it's in a totally negative way, because the Lord works in mysterious ways and evolution is beautiful but not pretty, but it is traumatic. And we see, again, if we want to use the integral maps, if the question is, what can integral bring to the party? You know, what's the integral view of this? What's the integral response to this? I think one of the things we do is we look at the map and see that we can see what the other stage responses are. And we see that the response of the amber traditionalist stage, or in spiral dynamics, the blue stage, these are the patriots, the fundamentalists, the people who are often derided, the deplorables in a way. And this is like the 35-38% of hardcore support for Trump. And they don't as much support him as they ally with him in their mutual hatred of, first of all, modernist globalism or orange globalism, and just this whole technocratic thing that outsourced their jobs to, second and third world countries, and that's true. And they're also mutual hatred, and in Trump's case, willingness to just punch him in the face, and that's the postmodernists and political correctness, which there is a deep antipathy for in traditional America. So there's that. And then we see the modernist response. And in some ways, the modernist response has been very encouraging, because the modernist realization as we move from traditionalism to modernism is that sovereignty lies not with a king, but with every person. And that we become a society of, as we say, laws, not men. And so we are seeing the empire strike back against Trump with courts and the media, for sure, our fourth estate, if you will. And, of course, the investigation arms of the Congress and the Justice Department are kicking in just naturally. And that is a reaction against the authoritarianism of Trump. And then you see in the Congress, the Republicans are really in a bind because they share the same base of traditionalists. 78% of Republicans still support Trump. These are the same people who support the congressional Republicans. And, it's malpractice to piss these people off too much, even though I think most of them are actually modernist enough to be personally repulsed by Trump. But they don't want to alienate their people. So they're hanging in there, and they're doing what modernists do. They're being practical, and they're running the machine. Thank God. The system is still working. And, they're trying to grind out some legislative sausage, and Trump seems compliant enough. They're not being particularly successful at it, but, a lot of them are practical people who, have a legitimate conservative agenda that they want to put forward. That's how the country works. So there's them. That's a modernist group. And then we have us greenies, the postmodernists, which is most of us on the call, I'm guessing, at least neck deep in it or waist deep in it. And the postmodernists are, of course, polarized against the traditionalists. Anyway, the traditionalists are misogynists and sexist and racist and homophobic and xenophobic, and You know, that's sort of their take on them anyway. And they hated George Bush plenty. But this Trump, I mean, there's a visceral repulsion. And I think it's a lot of just this antibodies to red and antibodies to, you know, green is still tribal. It's still first tier. I mean, tribal continues up. And so we all have that tribal part of us. And at Integral, we actually want to bring that online in a more conscious way, which is in some ways another discussion. But with green, I just want to make the point that there's a deep repulsion, hatred. My friend Gail sums it up. She just says he's evil. And he needs to be resisted on every front. And there's part of me who feels the same way, my green Jeff. And every time I need to get Green Jeff worked up, I just have to think about birtherism. And that was his original claim to political fame. And it just, you know, was enough to turn my stomach. So that, you know, the Integral response, and then I'm going to stop here just with the sort of laying out, you know, what is it? But at a minimum, it is, just to use the theory, it's the integration of the big piece of the truth that each of these previous systems have, and not their blind spots, including the blind spots of green. So I'll just, I think, leave it at that. And Di, you want to share what you're thinking?
Yeah, sure. Thank you, Jeff. And thanks, Jerry. Thanks for that kind of rundown of what's been happening. Yeah, I just have a couple of things to add. So one of the challenges that I've experienced since the election, and it really began the day after Trump was elected in our Integral Living Seminar last year where people were talking about the election, and there were people, you know, I don't think there was a Trump supporter in the room that I was aware of, but among the group of people, there was kind of a spectrum between, you might say, the people who were violently opposed to his presidency, who believed he was corrupt, who felt that we should immediately take a stand, who were angry, and who also to some degree kind of dominated some of the discourse because of the power of their feelings, and then the people who were waiting to see, and then the people who thought that, you know, he would become presidential, and then the people who thought we had an obligation as Americans to, you know, support our president, even though maybe we didn't agree with his agenda, and we still resist his agenda while not resisting him. So there was that big range of responses in the room. And one of the things that I experienced there was that we talk about, you know, when we look at the spiral or we look at Ken's description of development, one of the things that we say is that when we get to a certain post-green or green, when we hit a kind of pluralist level, that we really can start to listen to and hear other perspectives. And yet when we're under stress or we're under duress in this case or whatever it happens to be, that suddenly that ability to both have a perspective and hear other perspectives and tolerate the tension in the body-mind of those differences becomes reduced, and we tend to become much more singular in our ability to hold perspectives. And I feel like that happened for me in that setting. And I remember facilitating some conversation. It was kind of dicey in a way because it was very difficult for even that group of people to really hear each other, still maintain your point of view, still advocate for it, still be energized about it, and at the same time get that somebody else's point of view, there's something true and partial about it. So part of what I want to bring to tonight's conversation is just, you know, kind of a reminder to everyone on the call that one of the real privileges of being in Integral Conversations is that we get to sometimes have a deeper, wider, hopefully richer conversation because there's more room for perspectives, because there's maybe some ability to navigate different emotional states without panic. Maybe we can see the complexity in a different way. Maybe we have the use of developmental frames. That changes something. So I'm just going to kind of try and reflect at the end about some of what I appreciate about Integral Conversations, because for me, you know, political activity, whether it's in the form of a call to a congressperson or showing up at a protest or sending money to an environmental group or climate change group, that part to some degree is easier for me. I think the more challenging part is how do I engage in conversation with people who have really different perspectives? And that could be on any one day a difference with you, Jeff, or with you, Terry, or it could be, you know, differences in my family where I have people who are not in Trump voters, and maybe some who are actually currently still Trump supporters. And, you know, is there a difference? Is my political activism, do I navigate the terrain of my relationships around politics maybe somewhat differently than I do my activity, and what does that mean? So those things are on my mind right now, and I hope we can kind of visit some of the contours of the conversation at the end of our time.
Thank you so much, Di. I really love that. And it reminds me of another thing that we surfaced earlier when we were talking about this, which is that we also talk about these things in ways that always imagine that we are implicated, that we are participants, and that we are practitioners.
Yeah.
And
right.
That really distinguishes something about the kind of discourse we're engaged in. We are intending to grow in our capacity to show up as whatever we are, citizens of Trump's America, or perhaps global citizens of a emerging evolutionary fellowship. I don't know, but participants. So that means a lot.
Participants, and also maybe even at times going one step further and doing some shadow work where we actually try to find that red kind of warlord gangster part of us, you know, that just likes to wield raw power and have things our way and have everyone notice us. So, you know, but can we still be activists, you know, in the exterior quadrants while seeing the shadow pieces in the interior? So, yeah, thank you, Terry. Thanks for bringing that up. We're participants.
Yeah, so let me ask you guys a question. Terry, let me ask you. The liberal angst around Trump is really, you know, palpable. And I know you're plugged into it. I am too. I think probably most of the people on this call have some, you know, strong emotional response to the situation. And what do you think is, how do we make that productive? You know?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, this is a really, this is something I've thought about a lot, because I've been quite interested lately in, you know, integral soul work, archetypes, mythos. And Trump is, you know, he epitomizes all 10 of the 7 deadly sins. He's the poster boy for the archetype of the shadow king, the dark king, the tyrant, the brute, the bully. And that energy is so activating to us all that it's like we can't get his smell out of our house. And it kind of agitates us. We want to do everything we can to oppose him, but our irritation at the energy actually duplicates the energy. We become agents of the Dark King's energy in our upset, in our unconscious relationship to the way we consume the news, in our irritation, in our reactivity, in our willingness to dehumanize our cousins who, you know, the idiots who are supporting this travesty and so forth. And we lose our ability to hold a different frame, a different state, a different structure. And so that's really unproductive. But we're integralists. We don't just think in binary ways. It's not just that angst is unproductive under certain circumstances. Anger is the energy to change that which needs to be changed, and there is much here that needs to be changed. And so what rises up in us is energy we can use. That hit that we're taking from Trump is a gift to our capacity to show up in life, and that's very productive. So our horror at the cultural regression that he represents, we were for years thinking it was just a contest between the amber, blue, traditional values of somebody like George W. Bush and the more orange and green values of people like the Clintons and President Obama. And now suddenly we realize that the country's been taken over by red, by something even lower. And that is an issue.
That's
and we're not wrong. And our anger rising up isn't just a duplication of his energy. It's the rising up of the energy that is necessary for us to retain our liberal democracy. So I think both are true.
So, Di, let me ask you a question that sort of makes it personal. What do we do with – you just wrote a book called The Zen of You and Me. I'll plug your book. It's great.
Okay, great.
The subtitle being Dealing with Difficult People. I forget how it's worded. How do we deal with these people who voted for Trump and support him? Our cousins, our siblings, our, you know, do we bring it up? Do we not? Is there any way of looking at that that helps?
I mean, to the extent that, you know, we feel like we want to stay engaged and related, I would really support us in doing that. It's not necessarily easy. I mean, some people know who are listeners on the call because they were at the seminar, but I have three brothers, all of whom are military trained and all of whom voted for Trump. They didn't vote for Trump particularly because they supported him, but they definitely voted against Hillary Clinton. And so after the election, some people know I had this experience where the day before the election, I was coming to Boulder actually to meet with the two of you to do the seminar. And I was in a rather glib state of mind thinking that, you know, we were going to have 12 years of my value, you know, my political values in office and, you know, thinking about feeling a little bad for my brothers and then.
And this was election night, if I just might interject. Diana Terry came out. The last living room was the Thursday after the Tuesday of the election. You know, it was 48 hours later. So they were here already. We were just going to have a party. They came a day early so we could have a celebration of the first woman president together.
So we could sit around.
So here we are. So finish your story. Go on with your story, Diana.
Yeah, well, basically, as I was thinking about it, I was thinking, you know, feeling a little bad for my brothers, you know, and I had this fantasy that they would call me and congratulate me. Like, that would be my ideal, is that, you know, someone on the other side could actually reach across the net, you know, like in a sportsmanlike way and congratulate you. Well, the next morning, the idea that I would text them and congratulate them, I was furious. I was just furious. I felt like I'd been body slammed, you know. And so I did. And I texted them and I told them congratulations. And I've really been able to stay in relationship and talk to them. And I think it's necessary for us to do that. I mean, as I said, cast your vote, call your congressman, show up at a protest, send your check. But in your own relationships, understand that, you know, the worst thing about American politics is that because there's so much energy in these big polarities, and because, in my view, the media feeds those big polarities, that our ability to collaborate, to compromise, to reach across the aisle, to understand each other isn't modeled very well. I think we have an absolute obligation to do that in our relationships. I think we have to. You know, the Montana person that just body slammed the Nation reporter, like, you know, we know where extreme polarization leads, and it's not an option. So I would just, you know, basically invite everybody on the call to make yourself uncomfortable, listen to their point of view, really draw out the meaning in their vote, and then maybe ask if they can see another side to it. I did read a Nate Silver poll today that he said that Trump has lost about a third of his strong support, and that people are moving from strongly support to support or barely support. So there are some shifts that way, but I think we have to practice that. It's our developmental obligation, you might say. If you can take more perspectives, then it's your job to do that. So that's my
exactly.
Well,
It's even a survival imperative. You know, one of the things that is known among serious revolutionaries is that if there really is a, you know, when we feel that impulse to just dynamite the whole thing because we're so sick of the corruption of the political system, which is what happened with some of the more extreme Bernie supporters after they were so disappointed that he didn't get the nomination.
That's right.
There was a willingness to dynamite the whole thing. And under those circumstances, the intellectuals, and that includes the spiritual practitioners, are the first to go. We depend for these higher levels of development upon a basic civil society and order and all the rest. Okay. So the idea that we don't need to hang in there with our institutions is naive.
How are you feeling about the response of our institutions, Terry?
You know, I feel like, wow, people have to step in and really animate them, but I think we're going to make it through this. I'm optimistic, but cautiously.
Yeah.
How about you, Jeff? What do you think?
Yeah, I was going to ask you, Jeff, too, about how you feel about talking to your cousins and people you know who are Trump supporters. I'd just love to hear your view on that.
Yeah. Well, I'm really trying as a practice to find the piece of the truth and actually find it in my own mind body, because I still have that traditional strata there too. We all do. And green polarizes against it. Green, orange does too in a way. But what is it that's actually good and true about a patriotism that feels the vibe of the motherland, you know? What is it that is good about having an ethno, it's like we don't, in orange, people get homogenized into sort of urban and, you know, secular, but there's still something delicious about being Persian or British or, every culture. And I what Trumpism is a big shout from those people saying you're not going to go forward with your evolutionary project without us. And so, you know, you got to deal with us. And so I want to find that and see what they see that I don't, what I've lost track of. The idea of a culture where, of course, traditional values of honor and dignity and all of that stuff, even though isn't it just the biggest paradox in the world that the horse they're riding is Donald Trump?
Yeah.
But still, they prefer that to Hillary Clinton and all she represents, which is this thing that looks down on them, you know. So with that, what I do is I get really curious about my the person I'm dealing with. I don't want them to know what my point of view is necessarily. Most people can't resist being deeply listened to and questioned and explored. They explore themselves in the process. And maybe they find something, but there's no. I always love Trump's teaching on, you know, everybody has their karma, and to interfere with it and make them try to see something that they're not ready to see is an aggression on them. I always love that he went there with that, and so that backs me off. And I actually I hate to say like a parent to child, but a little bit like that, in that I don't expect their equivalent attention back.
Right.
And I don't get it.
Right.
So that's kind of,
you know, that really sparks
principles.
Yeah, that sparks something that I feel like I've been taught, which is that, you know, as Steve pointed out in a nice dialogue with you on the Daily Evolver, Jeff, you know, that there's an enduring polarity between globalism and nationalism. And that means that we're not going to go into this future as the triumph of an international, modern and postmodern and integral global citizens homogenizing and eliminating the old clans and tribes and races and religions and ethnic groups and the us-them dynamics of that. That even most of the globalists and the people who are going to decide elections, the independents who are on the fence, are dual citizens, somewhat global but somewhat provincial, somewhat in their ethnic identity of the us and them and somewhat standing outside it. And in a way, we globalists are a new tribe. We need to advocate for our values and compete, you know, adequately in the for those who are on the fence. But there's a soul in each ethnic essence. There's a soul to being Jewish. There's a soul to being Persian. There's a soul to being
American.
Dutch. And nobody wants that soul quality will just automatically resist an imperialism that would destroy it. And we've just learned a lesson through Brexit, through the Trump election, that there was a blindness to that among the global elites that I think has been erased forever. I think that's a really significant step in our cultural evolution.
Me too. I mean, I think it's happening in warp speed. And providing we survive this Trump thing, this guy who has his finger on the button, you know, let's pause for a moment and say a prayer. If we survive this, we will have learned a lot. And, you know, and cultural evolution will have happened at warp speed, I think. Di, what do you think?
Well, I think one of the things I just want to confess, and I'll be interested to hear what other people have to say about this, you know, so Terry, you mentioned, you know, the overly consuming the news, but I will say a couple things. One of the things you have to acknowledge in Trump is the he has a kind of media, an intelligence for the media. I mean, I've gotten more involved in the political process since he started to run. The campaign has just continued for me, and I've been more interested and more politically activated in a way than I have in years. And so that's been really interesting. And then, you know, it's almost like his reality television, you know, the way that he did reality television is kind of still going on, only now it's politics. And I'm kind of fascinated by how this thing is going to, where it's going, you know, like this whole plot with the Russians. And
I just wish there wasn't any bullet in the chamber of this Russian roulette game. You know, if we didn't have thermonuclear war as one of the possible endpoints, I'd find this whole thing utterly fascinating and only interesting instead of also terrifying.
I will point out, particularly for our non-American friends who, you know, are going to go down with us if this happens.
Yeah.
When Nixon was melting down, the military establishment decided among themselves that they would not follow any catastrophic order from him. So there is a precedent set. There's a groove in the cosmos, and let's pray that Mattis and those people would ignore this child, this big orange child.
But he is doing some damage to certain institutional safeguards, everything that wasn't actually legalized, everything that was a matter of convention and practice has been thrown into question. And we're in a more dangerous territory, and that does call upon each of us as citizens. I always feel that we need in the system activism, against the system activism, and around the system activism. We integralists are going around the system, but we have to do the in the system stuff too, not just vote. We have to participate, and I think this has driven that home, that point home powerfully too.
And we also have to do it creatively. I think one of the things that, you know, that we can count on a little bit is to be able to take a perspective on our fear and to, you know, find creative and interesting and provocative ways to respond that aren't just simply fear-based, that there could be some, you know, some creative responses too. It's like the situation calls for creativity, and I would think among integralists that there'd be an opportunity for people to think a little bit outside the box as well. I agree with you about being inside the system, and I'm interested in how the systems interact, and you know, it's a great course in civics for anybody, young people particularly, who haven't watched, to understand how the intelligence agencies work and how the courts work and what the executive branch does and how the legislature works and the judiciary, and it's, you know, it's pretty remarkable. I mean, it's kind of impressive just to watch all these. I mean, we, you know, government gets a bad rap, and our government is, you know, heavy and overburdened and sluggish and all of that. But it's also fascinating and amazing that it works as well as it does. So it's kind of nice from that perspective to watch the gears turn.
Yeah, it's really true. And, Terry, what you talked about with you know, sort of the outrage of the day. It is I mean, what Trump knows about reality television is that the show actually revolves around the villain, and he's a good villain, and I'm not sure it's even intentional. You know, I just think it's who he is. He doesn't seem to have a lot of mediating qualities. He's sort of a lot of id. I actually got a little sympathy for him by reading an article in The Atlantic about psychopathic children, and that it's actually a disability where these children have an inability to have empathy and to, you know, feel the pain of others. And the pain of others actually makes them happy. It's really something. And how some of the new ways of working with them. Although this wasn't about Trump, it actually gave me a little sympathy for him in terms of, you know, how he sees the world. Because I don't see the world that way, and it's hard to access that. But you know, we've seen it in the culture. In the news, the Turkish, when the Turkish president was here, you know, his security detail beating up protesters, giving one a concussion, in you know, where DuPont Circle or whatever it was, right downtown Washington, and you know, Trump calling Duterte the, you know, brutal dictator in the Philippines, and he likes these people, and it's. But what we're seeing, when we talk about the system withstanding him, is he doesn't get to shut down the media like these guys do. He doesn't get to send his goons out. He doesn't even get to suggest to Jim Comey that he cut his guy a break. It's really something. And I'm real encouraged by the response of the sort of modernist establishment to check this guy.
It takes some real courage, some real guts by the people who are filling these roles. Sally Yates had to do what she did. Jim Clapper had to do what he did. Rod Rosenstein had to do what he did. Each one plays an essential role. All the various
judges,
all
becoming heroes.
All the various attorneys. They are heroes.
Yeah, they're becoming heroes
really
to a vast
profound.
Majority. I mean, the traditionalists aren't maybe thinking that. But you know who seems to take courage these days to be is poor Spicy and Kellyanne. You know, I mean, I think those poor people are the ones that are, you know, have to suck it up every morning.
He's the only devout Catholic in Trump's inner circle, and he was the guy who didn't get to meet the Pope.
Poor guy. No, he's going to become an archetype.
Trump, gratuitous cruelty is Trump's forte.
Yeah.
Wild.
Yeah.
You know, Jeff, I just want to acknowledge something. You are the sunshine maker, I think, of the integral conversation. You're the only person who could recognize the fact that the only superpower in the world is led by a psychopath and find in it a basis for opening your heart to him.
At your service. I think that's part of the Integral Project. I do. I think we bring the outrage of green in. You know, that's part of the good, the juice of green. So, you know, I'm not, I like the resistance. But I do think that that can't be the only thing. And that, you know, love, I mean, God makes psychopaths. Psychopaths are people, too. So, you know, I'm not advocating other people do this. I don't think that other people ought to. But you know, at some point, it's if you're called to do it, that's what you want to do. And that is, you know, hold them in your heart. And I do.
Hold them in your heart and get them out of power.
And get them out of power, yeah. Totally. Absolutely. Yeah. And give him something to play with. All right. Well, should we bring in some other voices, gang?
Yes, yes. We wanted to frame up the question a little bit more in a more focused way. the question that I think we're most excited by is how, you know, what is the practice of being a true integral citizen of the world in the time of Trump? It is asking us to develop. It's asking us to grow in some way. What is that? And in some sense, all these different questions bear on that. So we wanted to hear from people in the community and give you a chance to make a brief statement. What we'll do is we'll call on you. Just press 1 on your keypad, and you'll your hand will be raised, and we'll be able to call on you. And then once we recognize you and invite you on, you'll have 60 seconds, and then you'll hear a bell like this. And then after a little while, we'll cut off your microphone. But we found that when we kept the pace going, that the quality of the community conversation seemed to really go up. So we'll
it's
do that. But please lean in. Please go ahead and press 1. We want to hear from as many of you as possible. There aren't too many hands up now, so you are invited. Mary Linda, thanks for raising your hand. Welcome.
Hey, thank you, Terry. Hi, Jeff and Di.
Hey, Mary Linda.
Hi. So
hi.
Hi, Di. What's really, really been coming up for me is that it feels like there's just this amazing emergence, and I call it awareness emergence, awareness intelligence maybe is even better, and that people are becoming so aware because we've got so much red, you know, that's demanding so much attention, and it's really bringing that. For example, real quick, and then I'll get off. I look where I was born in New Orleans, Louisiana, and they are taking down all the Confederate statues. You know, I mean, this is really a state that's so Trump and so traditional, and yet so much awareness going on there. So I think that's good. I think that's a good thing.
Yeah, I do too. Yeah, I would particularly draw people to or appoint people to the mayor of New Orleans, Mitch. I think his name is. It's Landrieu, at any rate.
Yes.
He did a talk or a speech on this, and he really helped me. Because, you know, there's a part of me who says, this is history, you know, and you know, as an integralist, I don't want to get in the business of blotting things out. But he said, okay, then let's have our monuments to slave markets. And I thought, okay, you got me there. And I don't know where it goes. I mean, I think for me, it's like I'll let them fight it out and to take these down or some of them. And then there's also a part of me that says, you know, so where that leads is, you know, if we really want to get to it, is Mount Rushmore. And Thomas Jefferson, who owned slaves and serially raped one for 20-some years by our standards. So, wow, it's really... so incendiary. There's so much karma that's just sparks with these issues. But I'm with you, Mary Linda, in that it's a space that is opening, that we're, you know, working in the next stage of the territory.
Thank you, Mary Linda. Ben, thank you for raising your hand, inviting you on the call. Go right ahead.
Hey, guys, can you hear me?
Yeah.
Loud
oh, that's
there.
Excellent. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Well, I wanted to bring in a bit of turquoise into the conversation by quoting from my good teacher, Ajay Shanti, who said this about activism. Often our activism is done from a divided state where we actually see good and bad and right and wrong. When we're in a state of inner division, even if we're doing something good, at the same time, we're pumping our inner division into the unmanifest. The universe registers division. So when it comes to our activism, the first thing we must become sensitive to is, am I divided here? Do I see an enemy? For if I do, then I'm not seeing the truth of things, and I myself am part of the problem that I'm trying to solve. So I'd just like to drop that one into the center and say I think that's the work that we all can do personally. Thanks.
I have a question, Ben, for you. So give us an example just from your own experience. How do you check in with yourself? How do you test this question of whether or not you're divided? How do you make a discrimination without coming from separation or division? Like, what does that taste like to you? How do you know?
I feel the tension of the paradox inside of me. I feel the struggle. I feel the fight inside of me. And I realize that when I do that, that's where the shift to more second-tier thinking and therefore experience comes in, as I work with my thinking to change my experience of how I'm holding it and how I'm feeling about it.
And so would you notice, for instance, that you might be feeling fear, let's say, in relationship to, let's just imagine you read an article about Trump's budget cuts, and do you experience some fear, or there's something that arises that feels like, you know, this budget is a problem, and do you then step back and shift your mind state? How does that actually work in practice?
I think what I do is, first of all, it would probably be more anger for me than fear.
Okay.
So the anger comes up, you know, look at what this guy's doing to the environment, yada, yada, yada. And I hold on to that, and I realize that while that may be true, it's also partial.
Mm-hmm.
And that there's a place that I can get to. I keep on coming back to that wonderful Chinese proverb, good, bad, who knows?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Yeah, and I just hold on to, I hold that good, bad, who knows, and that helps me to reduce my thinking that I'm right, that I have the answer.
And then do you still act? Because I think what happens for a lot of people, and this is myself included sometimes, is that my ability to act is sometimes impaired by the unbiased mind, you know, like I might be able to now see something larger, something that isn't good and bad in that kind of conventional and divisive way. But then are you still then inclined to act, mm-hmm. even though you're not judging it as heavily?
I believe that in many cases I would choose not to act because I come to the place where I realize that I don't have to act because I'm in a different perspective about it. And there are times when I would go ahead and act, but I'd be acting coming from a different place. But the action, somebody looking at that action would see that I might be doing the same action. They wouldn't understand that I would be coming from a different place in consciousness about it.
Wonderful. Thanks for illuminating that.
Blessings to you all. I love you both all. Thanks.
All right. You too, Ben.
Thanks, Ben. That was beautiful. Shika, welcome. You're on the air.
Hi, thanks. You know, this reminds me of there's this Zen story that I actually, the first time I heard it was from Diane a number of years ago about this bird who lives in a forest. And so one day in the forest there's a fire. And then the bird sees that, fire means suffering for all the forest animals. So she flies to a lake that's some distance away, and she fills her beak with water, and then she flies back to the forest and drops the water from her beak onto the fire. And she flies back and forth and back and forth until she falls into the fire exhausted and dies. And I love this story. This kind of, to me, illustrates this predicament of being human in a world with so much suffering, and which is so extreme and ubiquitous, that it can't be conquered without superhuman capacity. So, I mean, none of us alone certainly has the capacity to eradicate human suffering, but what we can do is we can act from compassion and we can continue with, you know, every fiber of our being to try.
Beautiful.
That's lovely. Thank you.
Thanks.
I see that, Daniel, you have your hand in the air.
Before we
come on.
Can I just say something that I just
yeah.
quickly sparked from the last caller, and that is
sure.
When we talk about finding what is good in traditionalism, there's a faithfulness, and of course, Orange Modernity wants to be successful, but there's something about just being faithful, like that bird, and then dying in the flames. That I think is juicy, and I want it in my integral world, you know, in my integral view.
Mm-hmm.
So anyway.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
Nice.
So welcome, Daniel.
You there, Daniel? Hello?
Yes, I'm here.
Okay.
Can you hear me?
Oh, now we
Hello?
Hear you. Yes.
Okay, sorry about that. So, yes, I'm actually calling you from New Orleans right now, so I had a keen interest on the previous comment in reference to New Orleans. It's interesting being as a New Orleanian for the last 23 years and being on the inside and watching the dynamic play out. This gives me a unique reference point, and I would just say one thing, that it's interesting that in the context of all this, it's happening. Next year is New Orleans' tricentennial, so it's pretty interesting as a marking off. There's huge momentum in the city around that culminating event. And there's a lot of things happening in the city, so to have this come down at the same time is a huge moment in New Orleans' legacy. And I would just say that even though, you know, you talk about the state of Louisiana, I think New Orleans is unique in that. I don't think that the majority of the state residents are in favor of those sculptures coming down. So that's one comment. The other one is just in terms of my own personal practice, I've never been more challenged before because I see the dynamic I experience in the most direct, visceral way when you have parents and relatives that, like Di pointed to, that are completely crystallized in a different point of view. And on top of that, I have a mother who is suffering from dementia. And it just adds a really powerful dynamic because I have people that are close to me also in my intimate relationship that is, you know, choosing not to engage. So I'm probably in the most difficult dynamic. If you have a spouse or a partner that won't engage, and yet I'm continually challenged to show up as my best possible self and to reach deep and wide and not from a place of violence or anger, but to really find those moments when the surrender to love is what pulls me in and allows me just to show up in that moment, in the dynamics, like a few weeks ago to go up and celebrate my mother's 80th birthday. And it was really powerful to be there in the context of that when there's so much, there would be so many other reasons not to be there if I listened to those voices. So, but the integralist in me, that part of me, that awakened awareness that says, you know, I see more, I have to be more, and thank God, how can I serve this? And so that's what I do.
Hallelujah.
Brother. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, thank you. I really appreciate that perspective. It's, you know, the whole issue with monuments is such an interesting one anyway, because monuments are kind of this funny attempt to fix history. And when we're taking different
mm-hmm.
views, you know, we fix history and then we're bound to it. You know, I've always ambivalent relationship about monuments for that reason. But, and also just
yeah.
thank you for just talking about your family, because there's so much of just the tenderness of
what it means to be a human being when things are challenging. Thank you for your comments.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Okay. Suzanne, nice to have you on the call. Welcome.
Hey, Suzanne.
Hey, Suzanne.
Are you there? We can't hear you. Maybe Suzanne's not really here. Okay. We will move on. Terry, welcome. Terry Dvorak, are you there? Oh, we're drawing two blanks.
Hello? Yes,
in a row.
I'm there.
Okay.
Sorry.
Oh, you are here.
Could you hear me?
Yes.
Sorry, I thought you said Gary. About Trump, I don't have that much fear about Trump really, because I kind of see it as a pushback, as Ken Wilber pointed out in his pamphlet that he published, essentially as a pushback against the Green, you know, the boomerities that he's wrote the whole book about. Which is really the pathology, I think, that Trump is pushed back against. And so looking at the spiral dynamics picture, I think what we have here is there was a gross misalignment there between the memes. And I think like some of the memes were not really participating. So now Trump is bringing them back. I think it's kind of a restoration of balance in my way.
Very good.
Thank you. Good to hear your voice. Okay. See, there's more hands up. Shauna, welcome. Shauna, are you there?
Hello?
Yes, hi.
Hi. Hi, Di. It's Shauna.
Guy may be muted.
Can you hear me?
Yeah.
Yes. We hear you fine.
Good. Oh, okay. I was hoping that you would speak a little more to what Guy was talking about her family. I have some really close friends that I love, and all of this has churned up things that I was caught unaware of, points of view. These are people who, compassionate, wonderful people who don't seem to have any kind of connection to what's going on for, say, millions of people who may lose their health care or their, you know, or insurance, or they're really unconcerned, and I'm sort of devastated by this. So I was hoping you could speak a little bit more to that.
You know, Shauna, what that reminds me of is something that I've found so useful. There's a book called The Righteous Mind by James Haidt, and he identifies that we have inbuilt moral senses. And that most of us feel that the most important moral determination is care for others and avoiding harm and suffering and pain and death and destruction. That's what morality is mostly all about. And we think that fairness and, you know, equal rights is another. But on the conservative side, there are a whole cluster of other biologically based moral intuitions that are equally strong. With fairness, they really want to emphasize proportionality, that you should only reap what you sow, and that people who give less should get less. And they really care about our group and loyalty to the group. Because we, you know, for hundreds of thousands of years, we were in these hunter-gatherer bands, and if you weren't loyal to your group, you were screwed. And part of that was a response to authority and obeying authority. And a lot of that was also connected with our idea of what was good and bad, true and false, what was pure and impure. And the idea was that the out-groups were barbarians. They were ugly. They were impure. And we were disgusted. We're disgusted by homosexuals. We're disgusted by the kids with the tattoos and the piercings in the city. We'd be disgusted by all kinds of things. And that those things resonate much greater for conservatism because they're not joined in these other biologically based moral senses by us. They feel that we use the care for the suffering of others as a exclusive morality, and we're superior over it, and they want to pull back against it. And that just helped me not feel quite so alienated by that and not find it quite so incomprehensible.
Would you repeat the name of the book, please?
It's called The Righteous Mind by James, H-A-I-D-T,
Jonathan.
I think it's spelled. It's Jonathan, sorry. Jonathan Haidt.
Thank you.
Okay, well, we're right at that time, Di, when we wanted to have a chance for you to talk about the potentials of integral conversation a little more. Di,
are you there? We haven't heard from Di in a while, I will say.
Just a second here. He disappeared. No, she's supposedly here. Oh,
no, I'm in the...
somehow. Hi,
hey,
Di.
Yeah.
There was something
Hi.
Triggered. Yeah, cut off your mic. I just returned it on.
Yeah, I see my mic's been off for a little while, but that's okay. What I'm most struck by at the end of this call, when we just look at, you know, what is it that we can practice and hope for and engage in integral conversations, whether it's about politics or anything that has meaning for us. And I think, you know, the first thing that I'm appreciating right now is just the presence of the heart. Just hearing from the callers and the listeners, some of whom I know and some of whom are new to me, and seeing that, you know, the very highly evolved language skills and cognition, that there's just this beautiful element where I feel connected, you know, emotionally and through the shared value of compassion and empathy. So that's the thing that's most alive for me right now. I think that the pleasure for me often comes with the fact that I can take a perspective, that I can advocate for the perspective, that I can become compassionate about it, and that maybe I'll even be challenged in my perspective, that there, you know, someone might challenge the way I see things and help joggle, you know, whatever's fixed in my mind to remind me that any conversation we're having in a way is really an exploration of awareness itself and of consciousness itself. We're referencing things in the outside world, but, you know, as Ben pointed out, it also is an expression of our own mind state. And how is it that we can both give and receive in conversation, support and challenge in conversation, so that our conversations have the safety or the togetherness that we often look for, and at the same time, there's the exciting dimension of being challenged. So that feels really important to me. How our identity may come and go, you know, as we start to be able to take a perspective on identity as a construct, as opposed to, you know, that I simply am Diane, but rather span self-image and self-referencing kind of arises in the mind and is an object like everything else in the mind, that actually leads to much more flexibility. And that means that I can shift identity. I can be for, I can be against, I can be Republican, I can be Democrat, and I also can be completely free of identity just to receive and hear what other people have to say. So I like that, being able to explore identity during the call tonight when we talked about, well, how does our, you know, that kind of innate ethnocentric loyalty to our own bloodline and to our, maybe our nationality, how does that get to play? And I think we get to play with that much more fruitfully when we can let go of it. It's fun to play with identity when you're not as attached to it. It's more difficult when there's no ability to take a perspective on it. So I really appreciated that about this call. the fact that we're kind of in an inquiry together and we're asking questions as opposed to, I mean, I'm like the, you know, I love an expert. I love listening to people that really know their stuff. You know, I like people who've, you know, when my husband speaks about the court system and how it works and how it plays, having been a lawyer and a judge, you know, I'm really interested in that. You know, when one of our friends like Suzanne speaks about developmental theory, I really love hearing what she has to say. But this conversation was somewhat free of that kind of, even though, you know, Jeff, you're a political pundit yourself and you put out the Daily Evolver and you spend as much time kind of tracking political discourse as anybody I know, you don't come away, you know, sounding like a know-it-all. And that's something that I also appreciate and enjoy. And if the conversation can really serve us, as you said earlier, as basically an opportunity to exercise awareness, to engage thought, to liberate thought, to engage identity, to let go of identity, and fundamentally to open the heart. And, you know, I was talking with Tammy Simon earlier. We were having a conversation. I referenced this Harvard study that's been done on men's well-being, and basically what it comes down to, as I understand it, some of the critical points of well-being is, you know, an ability to develop maturity emotionally, to maintain our relationships, and to contribute to culture, to have a little strain of altruism. And if we can use our conversations in support of that, regardless what it is we're talking about, then I think we've had a good conversation. So those are the things that came to my mind. That was kind of a mouthful. I hope that wasn't too much. But
that was great. Beautiful.
Yeah. You're very smart.
I have a lot of work.
You too, Terry. And you too, everybody.
You know, we've managed to fool each other at least, huh?
Well, you know, it is. The integral view is a new thing. It's a new era of human history, and we're carriers, and we're, you know, at least working on it. And I love the conversations we have, and I hope that anybody who is interested hangs in there with us, and we're going to continue to do calls and consider attending. Again, November 9th through 12th, and Early Bird is still online for another 3 weeks. You can find out more about it at integrallivingroom.com. And anything that you want to say to close up, Terry?
You know, I think we should say that it's quite possible that this may be our last time of being able to do it at the Integral Center,
Yes. Which
is a very special setting. So if you're in any way part of the family, friend of the family, we'd love it if you'd be there with us for this one. It'll be especially sweet. And it's $5.99 for the next 3 weeks. After that, it'll go up to $6.99. So consider registering.
Cool.
It's been a pleasure.
Well,
talking
I'm good.
With you all. Me too.
Yeah, likewise. Yes, indeed.
It's
so
been
Terry,
really fun. Let's open up the mic so people can say goodbye. Yeah, I love to hear everybody's voice. So hang on a second.
Thanks for joining us, everybody.
Goodbye, everybody.
Thank you so much.
Bye.
Lots of love.